Welcome to today's edition of the Rush Limbaugh Show podcast.
It is an honor to be on EIB. Mark Stein said it well. We're always, when we're guest hosting, we're always sitting in for Rush Limbaugh. It's 800-282-2882. If you want to join us on today, that the day Lord has made for all of us. And I choose to be grateful, and it is a week. It's going to be a week since we lost Rush. And it's still sometimes like you, I'll tune into the show and I remind myself, we've been without the Maha who's gone on to heaven. You've heard Catherine, his beloved wife, address the audience and take phone calls. And that was an historic day. And there's an historic radio show and radio network that exists because people who love Rush built it with him. And that includes you. And you can call in at 800-282-2882. So wouldn't you know this? Rush has moved on to heaven. And still, liberals and statists are just beside themselves. They're in the state of Florida, Ron DeSantis, he's the governor, the boss. He ordered that the flags be flown at half staff in Rush's adopted home state of Florida. So the Democrats' response to this is sort of a nonviolent insurrection, you might call it. The Democrat Agricultural Commissioner of Florida, Nikki Fried, refused to take the orders of the governor for whom she works. She refused to fly the flag at half staff. And this all was discussed yesterday morning. CNN, which used to be a news network, as a co-host there, John Berman, spoke with this nonviolent insurrectionist, the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services head, Nikki Fried, about her decision to defy the governor's order to floor the flags to half staff. And they had this exchange.
Why do you refuse to lower the flags at the buildings that you control?
What he's doing is he's bending over backwards to honor a radio host who spent his entire career talking hate speech and talking bigotry and division and conspiracy theories. And lowering our flag should be a symbol of unity, not division. Raising our standards, not lowering our standards. So we will not be lowering our flags at my department, state offices, to honor Rush Limbaugh.
Fire her. Let's have done with her. This is a person who quite clearly has never listened to Rush's program, even for 5 minutes. You know, and Rush has said, for those of us who recognize that there's no graduate degrees from the Limbaugh Institute for Advanced Conservative Studies, right? Most recently added the anti-media studies wing. But DeSantis, the governor who gave this order, and this woman has refused this order, was definitely on the Institute's honor roll.
I want to start, however, with a graduate or the closest that we've ever had to a graduate of the EIB Limbaugh Institute, and that would be Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. As you know, there are no graduates from the Limbaugh Institute because the learning never stops. We don't issue degrees here because there never is a time where we have proclaimed that our students have learned it all. Or that because our curriculum is constantly expanding. There is no set curriculum here. But Governor DeSantis has asked in the past for an honorary degree. And Governor DeSantis has said that if said honorary degree were ever bestowed, that he would hang it proudly on the wall in his gubernatorial office. And if anybody has come close to earning an honorary degree from the Limbaugh Institute, it is the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis. He has clearly had enough of the drive-by media. After months of being slammed by fake news and by the gloom and doom casualty forecasts over his handling of the coronavirus, the governor called them out.
This is why we've talked about this in the program. This is why Ron DeSantis got our dear Professor Limbaugh's attention. This was on Rush's final program. February 2nd, Rush spoke with a lot of admiration for Governor DeSantis and how his courage, in his courage to stand up to the left, and how this made Ron DeSantis a target.
Have I mentioned lately how much I admire the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis? He has launched an ambitious crackdown on big tech. Somebody with the guts to do it. Somebody also not closing down his state because of the COVID virus. Ron DeSantis, this guy has got what we call an iron enforced spine. The governor of Florida, in a 45-minute speech this morning, the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, identified big tech companies as the leading threat to American democracy and freedom of expression today, and pledged that Florida Republicans would take action. He accused the tech giants of clear viewpoint discrimination, highlighting the censorship of Donald Trump and the removal of Parler from the Internet and Apple and Google-controlled app stores. He said the core issue here is this. Are consumers going to have the choice to consume the information they choose, or are oligarchs in Silicon Valley going to make those choices for us? No group of people should exercise such power, especially not tech billionaires in Northern California. And man, oh man, is that right. And tell me, where else do you hear anybody speaking out like in government? Yeah, you have some op-ed writers, some other people speaking out on this, but this, you don't hear elected officials so much. Well, some members of Congress do. Miranda Devine in the New York Post today has a great piece on the same subject, and that is these tech oligarchs literally running the news business, running the opinion. They're running the information business in America. And we are watching, let me just tell you, we are watching the de facto merger of media and social media and state government. The merger of giant corporations and state. This is when Democrats control Washington. The propaganda arm of the Democrat Party has never been more powerful than today. And don't forget that they've got Antifa and Black Lives Matter soldiers as their military arm. Republicans who do not cave to the extraordinary pressure exerted on them in Washington today. You know who they are? They're tomorrow's leaders. Republicans who do not cave to all of this are tomorrow's leaders. Trump is the model going forward. Yes, sirree, my friends. Donald Trump is the model. You find something interesting. It was just made aware to me. I got a note from somebody. You know, it's been 2 weeks we haven't heard from Trump at all. 2 weeks. That hasn't happened in 4 years. 2 weeks. In these same 2 weeks, we've heard nothing but Trump, Trump, Trump from the Democrats and the media. And I had the same observation today. I was watching CNN, and they were doing a story about how incompetent the Trump team was last December in the Oval Office. And I said to myself, is it so bad that there's no news? That the only story you've got is what a rotten guy Trump was last December? It was a story about how conspiracy theories were the dominant subject in a knockdown, drag-out discussion conversation in the Oval Office in the middle of December. I'm saying, you know, we've got a brand new president. We've got all kinds of stuff happening. We've got the impeachment coming up. And all you guys at CNN can do is a long, drag-out story on Donald Trump's December? He's gone. He's no longer president. It doesn't matter. And yet it does. Apparently to them, they are not going to let up on the gas pedal, folks. They're going to continue whatever they think they have to do to destroy the guy, to impugn the guy, to ruin the guy, his family, supporters. They're not going to let up on the gas. Just amazing.
Just amazing to hear Rush talk about this merger of the state and social media and tech. And this was on Rush's final program just this week, as this Dr. Rachel Levine, who's a man who presents as a woman, is wanting to be assistant health secretary, a failed so-called public health director, is one of his big issues is wanting kids to be able to not go through the wrong puberty, as if that's a possibility, that they would go through the wrong puberty. It's an incredibly radical position. Rush spoke of the merger of state and tech and social media. This week, Amazon disappeared a book. It's a scholarly book. It's called When Harry Became Sally. Incidentally, it is written from a perspective of profound love for people. I've read the book. I've read it twice. And it's written from a perspective of concern for people, particularly kids who are confused and being caused to be confused about their gender, because the left is merchandising this. Amazon has disappeared the book. And you have Zoom. A app made or blessed by the Chinese Communist Party sent a warning letter to a woman who is what's called a gender skeptic. She doesn't believe that boys can become girls and vice versa. This is Zoom, a communication app that said you can't continue to teach this. And there was the Maha on his last show warning about all of this. And of course, he was right. We'll continue in the Rush Limbaugh program. Todd Herman filling in on the EIB network. Todd Herman in on the EIB network and sitting in for Rush Limbaugh. It's been a week. It will be this week, a week since we lost Rush to God Almighty. And it's still a gut punch to say it. And there's still people dealing with that fact. And we just talked about in the last segment, Rush was talking about there's there's no graduation from the EIB Institute for Advanced Conservative Studies because the learning never stops. This is true today. The Democrats Barack O'Biden has nominated William Burns to run the CIA. Who is Billy Burns? William Burns was one of the negotiators who decided to ship hundreds of millions of dollars to Iran illegally overnight in foreign currency on pallets in an illegal. It wasn't just illegal because it's a ransom payment. The reason they sent cash is they were not allowed to have a banking relationship with Iran, which is a document that Obama had to sign multiple times. They want to bring this guy back, you know, and this is business as usual for the establishment. Rush Limbaugh spoke about how establishment Democrats treat the enemies of this country.
The president before Donald Trump was Barack Obama. And what did Barack Obama do to make deals with our enemies? Why, he gave them nuclear power. He enabled them to make nuclear weapons. And then when that wasn't enough, Obama delivered $150 billion of cash on pallets to the Tehran International Airport for the mullahs to come and sweep up and take back to their palace. What did Kim Jong-un get? He didn't get in on that action. Can you imagine Kim Jong-un thinking, if I would have just tried to do this with Obama, look at how I could have profited. What might I have been able to get out of Obama that the Iranians did? Instead, I did a deal with Trump, and all I've got to show for it is a video demonstrating how there might someday be condos on my beaches. It's a funny thing to ponder. And make no mistake, Kim Jong-un saw what Obama did for the Iranians. And he's got to be kicking himself that he didn't try to give in on some of that. Timing is everything, as they always said. Trump made that point in his interview. He did Stephanopoulos first today. And Stephanopoulos said something along the lines, well, now you did a deal with this guy, and you're constantly critical of the Iran deal. It's a very low bar because it's a bad deal. And Trump said, well, hell yes, it was a bad deal. We got this deal with North Korea without having to deliver $150 billion to their airport. And, of course, Stephanopoulos was just speechless. In the meantime, Obama giving them $150 billion and enabling a nuclear weapons program. Does that matter? Hell no. What matters is Obama's style, and he was glib, and he was well-spoken, and he came off as intelligent, and that's all we care about is the style, the surface. Contrast that with a bunch of chihuahuas nipping at Trump's ankles ever since this deal was signed last night. And I still maintain that they were shocked by it. I really think these people are so lost in their criticism of Trump that they literally believe all of it now. You know, all this stuff they've made up, Trump's an idiot, Trump is dangerous, they believe it. They don't think it's possible for him to succeed, despite the fact he's succeeding week after week after week right in front of them.
So this is what's coming back. I want to put the guy back in charge who, you know, negotiated. Well, we'll bring him on pallets. We'll bring you cash. That's not negotiation. It's paying off terrorists. Phenomenal. Kathy in Owensboro, Kentucky. You're on the Rush Limbaugh program. Kathy, I'm glad you called to talk about our dear Rush. It's Todd Herman sitting in for the Maha who's in heaven.
Thank you, Todd. Good morning. It's such a pleasure to speak with you. I enjoy your show as we navigate this new terrain. You all are doing an excellent job. I just wanted to say that I remember listening to Rush one time when he said, if there's one thing I wish I could do for all of you people out there, I wish I had a magic wand that I could wave over you and you would not care what others thought about you. And that I just stopped. I was like, oh, gee. And it just kind of resonated. It makes you realize just how much we don't speak up because we think of what others are going to think of us. And Rush just pounded that home, and I'll never forget him saying that. I can hear him saying it right now in my head.
You know, Kathy, you're one of millions of people who can hear this advice from Rush. And you know what's phenomenal is how many people I've communicated with since Rush's passing who've told me personally or sent me emails, hundreds of them, and I'm woefully, woefully behind in trying to respond to as many as I possibly can. And I'm just a guy who fills in. But all continually talking about life advice and items like that. And yet, you know, I've also talked to people. I talked to a woman who took Rush to Afghanistan, and she talked about how gracious he was to people and how curious he was and how he sought information and listened intently to people and had this great concern for this woman, Peggy O'Ban, who took him to Afghanistan. Peggy, don't get out of the Jeep. It's dangerous. Rush pulling her back in, and she's saying, oh, this is my job. I can do these things. So do you demonstrate this behavior? Kathy, do you go about speaking truth in the face of tyranny?
Absolutely. Yes. I try to do it in a strong way without coming off as being hateful, if I could use that word. You know, and I think that's another thing. We have been conditioned here of late to just be hateful, and it's okay. And Rush did not, you know, he gave us the information we needed. We've got it stored in our brains and in our hearts, and we're going to carry it on.
Yeah. And that speaking up, I heard Rush do an incredible monologue about this. I believe it was a Pew study that a majority of conservatives do not exercise the First Amendment rights. And a majority of American Christians do not exercise their First Amendment rights to speak out. And in fact, you know, I spoke about this on my morning show this morning that because I've been in a red state, it's I'm just now waking up to, my goodness, even I censored myself sometimes in business meetings, etc. Right? Well, I wouldn't, you know, put up with lies, but I censored myself. I just had a discussion with a doctor the other day, and we talked about our faith, and we talked about our views of children, and it was so refreshing. And I got out and realized, my goodness, this is stifled in these cities. And Rush challenged us in that monologue, as I recall, look, this, if you want your country back, you need to speak out. So for you to remember that as the magic wand story, that's a great way to remember our Rush. And this one week that since we've lost Rush, there's much more to get to, much more of Rush Limbaugh's voice. Todd Herman on the EIB network. You know what? Last week, saying goodbye to the Maha was so hard. And I am just sitting here enjoying Just hearing a man who did use his First Amendment rights to all of our benefit. And there, you know, people who defy the odds, like Rush did in every capacity. Rush defied the odds because of hard work and hustle and optimism. Too many times people who pull that off, they defy the odds. They forget how hard that was. And Rush never forgot that. And, you know, Rush, of course, loved the game of golf. And Tiger Woods, our prayers for him, was in a serious accident. And I hope he's able to recover from this. Apparently, he's got a broken leg that's required surgery. And America loved the comeback story of Tiger Woods. when he won the Masters Golf Tournament 2 years ago. Rush made the most unique observation about Tiger Woods and yourself. Listen to this.
I want to say something to you, because I know every one of you, almost without exception, every one of you can learn from this. If you waste time worried about what other people think of you, I want you to remember two words: Tiger Woods. If you ever worry, I remember this has been a pet peeve of mine, people so concerned what other people, it's what drives Washington. Republican Party obsessed with what the media thinks of them. Obsessed with what the Democrats who are perceived to run that town think of them. And it's paralysis. And it's irrelevant what people think of you. It shapes who you are instead of allowing you to be who you are. If you're always worried about what people think of you or what people are going to say, and every one of us is, well, I'm not. I used to be, but I'm not anymore. This job taught me I had to get rid of being worried about what other people think, particularly people I don't even know, and then particularly people that don't even listen here. But for those of you worried that you can be eternally damaged or hurt by what people think of you, never forget Tiger Woods. How many years ago was it? 12 years now? 11, 12 years ago? Tiger Woods was the biggest joke in this country. He had reached the pinnacle that few ever reach in any endeavor. And in one Thanksgiving weekend, it all came crushing down. And he lost not everything, but he lost a significant amount of things that were of dire consequence and importance to him, including his wife. And for a time, he was worried about losing his kids. He lost all of the respect, and he knew that when he began playing golf again after going through the necessary rehab, that no matter where he went, the only thing people were going to be thinking about was all of the controversy involving that news, which led to his decline and fall. He couldn't escape it. When he first started playing golf again, people aren't looking at him to see how well he plays. They're looking at him, and he thinks they're laughing, but he had to fight through it. Then he has all of these injuries and all these back surgeries, and then there's that video where he's pulled off the side of the road and can't walk a straight line because his doctors have him on some kind of drug cocktail to deal with the pain and everything else from all of these back surgeries that he's had. In his never-ending quest to get back to being able to play professional tournament golf. And it went on for 12 years. And he started playing well in tournament golf late last year, won the tour championship at East Lake in Georgia. And when he started playing well is that moment in time when people started seeing him as he was prior to the big fall. And folks, do not underestimate this when I tell you. His first trip back to the Masters, the club president at the time, after the decline and fall, after the story about all the hookers and the girlfriends and all of that, that the sex rehab, all of that, the most humiliating stuff, and every bit of it was public. Every step he made, every thing he had done, was made public, and there wasn't anything about it that was redeeming. It blew up every image of him anybody had. It destroyed everything. So bad that on his first trip back to the Masters after all of that, the then chairman of Augusta National at the time, Billy Payne, felt it necessary to make a speech on the opening day of Masters Week about how the Masters is not crazy about all that immorality and people that don't treat things with respect. It was a direct message to Tiger Woods, and he had to take it. People that had treated him as the greatest on earth were now mocking and laughing and lecturing and preaching. I had people ask me all the time, you think Tiger will ever win again? I said, I don't know, but they meant win a major, which he did yesterday. So now he's up to 50. Now he's three away from tying Jack Nicklaus's record. prior to yesterday, people didn't think it was possible. One win, and now everybody says, oh, look out. You may even do it this year. Because the next two majors, well, in the United States, Bethpage Black, which he has won there on Long Island, and Pebble Beach, the U.S. Open in June, Pebble Beach, which was the site of his greatest victory, beat the field by, what, plus 12 or plus 15. It was an incredible tournament. So now people are talking about he may be able to come back just in one victory. But people ask me, do you think he can win a major? I really don't know. But I'm going to tell you what I don't know, Tiger, but I'm going to tell you what I think happens. Whenever he plays golf, you've got the gallery, and he knows. And the gallery, you can see the gallery as you're playing. He knows that they're looking at him and thinking about all that stuff they learned about him that he hoped nobody would ever know. Well, let's jump forward from all of that to yesterday. There was nothing but overwhelming happiness, love, respect, and welcome back on the part of virtually everybody in the gallery at the among the patrons. You got to call them the patrons when you talk about the Masters. But everybody in the gallery. Now, 20-some-odd years later, he comes off the 18th green, having won again something nobody thought he would ever do, and there is his mom and his kids, and the cycle is completed. If there is ever any doubt in your mind that you think you have been humiliated and embarrassed and put down to such a degree that you can never again face people, just think Tiger Woods. It is not only possible. America loves a great comeback. America loves champions. Americans love greatness. They love people who pursue it. They love people who excel at it, and they love people who achieve it. I can't tell you the number of people have sent me texts. Hey, how can that happen in such a racist country? See all those white people cheering Tiger Woods? Exactly my point, folks. We're not a racist country. If we were, the wealthiest woman in America would not be an African-American overweight TV star. And I've maintained that for I don't know how many years. Could America love a comeback story any more than this one? Do you wonder what it feels like to have literally the entire world, let's just get the entire country. Now, granted, there are going to be some exceptions, but you get my drift here. But I think Tiger has a new humility about him that it probably doesn't contain. See, I told you so. He's probably not running around, take that down. I don't think that's who he is anymore. I think he's genuinely appreciative. I think he was genuinely appreciative of the adulation and the appreciation, the applause that he got yesterday. He's genuinely appreciative of the factors that came together for him to return to championship form. One of the things I've admired about Tiger Woods is he's shown the way how to be a friend, how to remove politics from his public comments. You know, he and Donald Trump have been friends for years. And he played golf with Trump and Jack Nicklaus about 4 or 5 weeks ago now. So Tiger Woods shows that not only can you come back, but then you can regain the respect and the love and the adulation. And I'll tell you, the people playing the game of golf are happy as hell he's back. Bigger TV audiences, better everything. So the next time you get worried about what people think of you, and it'll happen maybe in 10 minutes from now, 20 minutes, whatever. Just remember Tiger Woods.
People who didn't know Rush didn't know approaches like that. If you have the Limbaugh letter, look back through it, because Rush interviewed Tiger Woods' father in that. Life lessons will continue. EIB Network, Todd Herman filling in for our friend Rush Limbaugh in heaven. It's Todd Herman on the EIB Network, and it's always going to be filling in for Rush. It's a week since we lost our friend, Rush Limbaugh. He was early on to see Fauci. I just was remembering a monologue where he was talking about the media trying to make Fauci president. I remember this. And Fauci. So despite the fact that there is the Moderna mRNA injection and the Pfizer mRNA injection, and their paperwork says this isn't going to give you immunity. It'll make the sickness less bad if you get it. Right. We're still, this is still being pushed. Fauci is saying the things that even if you're vaccinated, you're not going to be able to do in society. For example, you know, indoor dining, theaters, places where people congregate. He even said, I don't know that grandmas can hug their kids anymore, the grandkids. So Rush Limbaugh gave us the most understandable and durable explanation of what the deep state is and who it is. And of course, Rush was on to Tony Fauci.
Well, let's go back, shall we? Here is Dr. Fauci, January 21st, 2020. A year ago, he's on NetMax TV's Greg Kelly Reports. Greg Kelly's question to Dr. Fauci, bottom line, we don't have to worry about this coronavirus, right?
Obviously, you need to take it seriously and do the kinds of things that the CDC and the Department of Homeland Security are doing. But this is not a major threat for the people in the United States, and this is not something that the citizens of the United States right now should be worried about.
You realize when this was? This is 1 year ago, folks. 2020, 2021 years were together. This is January 21, almost exactly 1 year ago, and Dr. Fauci said, and he's got science on his side, he's now infallible. Dr. Fauci, this is not a major threat for the people of the United States. This is not something the citizens of the United States right now should be worried about. Nah, you got to take it seriously, but it isn't of any concern. Okay, so you're the American people. You're being told that this guy knows more than anybody else about this. And this guy's telling you, you don't have a thing to worry about. You want to talk about costing lives? Donald Trump never told anybody, don't worry about it, like Dr. Fauci did. Dr. Fauci, with the imprimatur of expertise, is saying to people, you don't have a thing to worry about, 1 year ago. And let's jump forward to March. March the 8th, 2020, on 60 Minutes. The chief medical correspondent, Dr. John LaPook, interviewed Dr. Fauci, asked him, there's a lot of confusion around people and misinformation surrounding face masks. Can you discuss that, Dr. Fauci?
The masks are important for someone who's infected to prevent them from infecting someone else. Right now in the United States, people should not be walking around with masks.
You're sure of it? Because people are listening really closely to this.
There's no reason to be walking around with a mask. When you're in the middle of an outbreak, wearing a mask might make people feel a little bit better, and it might even block a droplet, but it's not providing the perfect protection that people think that it is. And often, there are unintended consequences. People keep fiddling with the mask, and they keep touching their face.
Wow. So back in March of 2020, you don't need to be wearing a mask. You really don't need. There's no reason to be walking around with a mask on. When you're in the middle of an outbreak, wearing a mask that might make you feel better, might even block a droplet here and there, but it's not providing protection that people think it is. Now, where are we? We have a mandated national mask policy if you're on federal property. Except if you're Biden, you don't have to wear the mask when you're celebrating at the Lincoln Memorial, but everybody else has to have it. But back in March, the infallible Dr. Fauci, you don't need to wear it. It's just giving you a false sense of security. Now, my friends, I want you to know I am on the outside guardrails of protection here. Because criticizing Dr. Fauci is close to criticizing Biden. You're not supposed to do that. Now, I've gotten very, very close to this by pointing out this hypocrisy.
Everybody just joined me in remembering no one. Look, I don't want to get back into memorializing our friend. We did that last week, but no one. Could I lift the mask off for a second as the talk show host? I do radio every day. I've played those clips many times. I can't do it like that. No one combined seriousness and humor and mockery and facts that way. There's so much to continue to hear of Rush's voice. It's Todd Herman on the EIB Network. Truly, it's Todd Herman in for on the EIB Network, in for our friend Rush. And sitting here remembering his life and what he did on radio, truly, we were just talking during the break. I'm one of you. We're one of us, to say it a better way. I'm a lifetime listener. But I'm a lifetime enjoyer of Rush and reader of the Limbaugh Letter and it's all my adult life. But it's sitting here in the studio listening to that presentation. I don't pretend to be a program director or a radio boss. I love radio. I grew up around it. That was just a phenomenal presentation of fact and data and humor all mixed at once. And that's the piece that I think drove the left batty, that they couldn't tell sometimes when Rush was really mocking them. And when people can't figure out if they're being mocked, that is the most uncomfortable position to be in. And Rush put them in that position all the time. If you listen to the incredible broadcast with Mark Stein and Catherine Limbaugh, she spoke about Rush's insatiable desire for information. That, you know, getting done with the show, maybe a 15-minute break, but right back into consuming information. That kept us on the edge, cutting edge of societal evolution. We'll prove that point, as if there's any doubt, in this next hour's, first segment of next hour. We'll prove this point, plus a socialist who had his life changed by Rush Limbaugh. It's Todd Herman on the EIB Network. It has always been and always will be an incredible honor to speak over the top of this bumper music. And Mark Stein, I think Mark made it official. We guest hosts, we are still filling in for Rush, who would be here if he could. It was a week ago that my wife said to me, I was just headed into my home office. My wife said, "Oh, dear God, Rush." And I thought, no. And then I got a text from a member of Team EIB. And it was a week ago that we had a very, very emotional show on a day like today. Is the day the Lord has made, and last week was the week that the Lord, you know, as I've heard Bo Snerdly say on Fox News, took his talent back that was on loan from God. I heard Catherine talk about Rush's insatiable desire for knowledge. She did something historic. I've never heard the wife of a celebrity, and Rush was a thinker and a writer and a celebrity, right, a worldwide celebrity. I've never heard a celebrity wife spend time with fans and family, and we do feel like family of Rush's as listeners. And speaking of that, you can call us at 800-282-2882. She talked about this insatiable need that Rush just needed to be reading. And Rush, you know, as we see science and scientific rigor under assault by the left in every capacity, I remember that Rush loved legitimate scientific rigor. He loved technology. And again, I've been in the car with people who weren't Rush fans, and he was talking about Apple, and I've had people say, "Wow, wow, he knows his stuff." And these are tech people. So he once said, if if he hadn't have gone into radio, he'd gone into aviation. That extends to, of course, space exploration. Now, earlier this week on Fox News Channel's special report with Brett Baer, Brett said this about the release of the first videos of the Perseverance rover landing on Mars.
NASA releases its first video of the Perseverance rover since arrival on Mars last week. The three-minute presentation shows an enormous orange and white parachute hurtling open and then the red dust kicking up as rocket engines lower the rover to the surface. Perseverance will spend the next 2 years exploring the surface of Mars and drilling into rocks that may hold evidence of life in the past.
So from a radio perspective, you're not to go off format the way Rush could and did. And we were all the better for it. You know, if you're a regular listener, you knew about this event. You probably knew about it in a way that puts you and me on the cutting edge, as Rush would say. You know, he used his radio program and network to communicate his fascination with technology and space. And I believe because it expressed human curiosity and hard work. And he coupled that with his own insatiable curiosity. So it drove him to learn everything he possibly could about something that interested him. And then it spanned many, a huge array of subjects that he communicated with us, his audience. On Rush's second to last show, he was still exploring. Rush did. He just did that thing about loving these topics. And he said this about the expected landing of that very Perseverance rover on Mars that Brett Baer just mentioned.
Okay, folks, you know me. I'm a person fascinated with tech, such as what your phone can do, your iDevices, your computer, what have you. But there's something coming up that literally amazes me, and it's a thing that just boggles my mind that we, as human beings, have the power to do this. NASA is about to land another rover on Mars. It's called Perseverance. It's scheduled to land on November the 18th, I believe. The landing sequence is automated, so NASA engineers can't do anything but sit back and hope for the best. Well, what are the obstacles? Well, the spacecraft has about 25 million miles to go in its 292 million mile trip. It's currently closing the distance at 1.6 miles per second. Now, once at the top of the Martian atmosphere, an action-packed 7 minutes begin. That is the time of the descent through the Martian atmosphere to the surface of the planet. In addition, or as part of this, the temperatures that will reach the surface of the spacecraft will be equivalent to the temperatures on the surface of the sun, and it will not melt. If all goes well, it will not evaporate, it will not vaporize, it will not be destroyed. It will be able to withstand temperatures equivalent to the surface of the sun. Then the first supersonic parachute inflation happens. All of this has to happen on a sequence that controllers will have no control over. Because of the distance between Mars and Earth, controlling the spacecraft in real time is out of the question. It takes minutes for a command from NASA on Earth to reach the Perseverance rover. So it's up to the spacecraft and the software that's been written to execute numerous tasks at split-second timing. And it also has to account for any variables that could threaten the descent and landing. It has to recognize something out of whack and make an adjustment, make an adaption, because unlike landing on the moon's close enough, quote-unquote, where we could send alternate landing instructions. But Mars is so far away that all we can do is sit there and watch for 7 minutes as this spacecraft plummets. The Martian atmosphere reaches temperatures equivalent to the surface of the sun. Parachutes have to deploy. It has to land at the exact speed. If it doesn't, damage could happen. The rover could be destroyed at any phase of this landing. And nobody can stop it if something goes wrong because of how long it takes a command instruction sent from Earth to reach the rover, which at the point in time will be in orbit around Mars. Now, this just fascinates me, and I understand these controllers are going to be biting their nails and going nuts during these 7 minutes, being unable to correct anything. And for much of the 7 minutes, because of the heat generated by reentry, they won't be able to have any communication with the rover at all. But even so, whatever communication they get would be delayed because of how far Mars is.
You're not supposed to be able to do that, to go off format, and he did. And Rush also knew where he came from. One of the regrets that our friend had in his life is his dad never got to see or fly an EAB-1. They can visit it about it now in heaven, because aviation wasn't just Rush's passion, it was that of his father as well.
I got so many nice emails yesterday from people throughout the aviation industry thanking me for informing people as to all of the tentacles that spread out from a corporate jet, even from its manufacture to service, completion and so forth. And I want to thank all of you for those nice emails. It was a subject close to my heart. I've been fascinated with aviation all my life. My father was a lawyer, but if he really would have fulfilled his dream, he would have run a major airport somewhere. My father flew P-51s in the China-Burma theater of World War II. He also was an instructor on B-25s. I think I've seen a picture of him outside one. I think it was in Alabama in World War II. I'm not totally sure about that. He had a little Cessna 182 for a while when we were growing up. And I was there. My mother took flight school lessons. She went to her ground school and did her solo and so forth and got her instrument rating with the hood. I saw all this as I was growing up. And I've been fascinated with aviation all my life. My dad got every flight magazine there was, aviation, flight, whatever. And he was reading them. And if I may get personal here for a brief moment before we go to the break, my father and mother would not believe my life. One of the saddest things, one of the most regretful things I have is that my father died before we acquired EIB-1. He would have not believed it. I would not have been able to get him out of the cockpit jump seat. He would have tried to go get his jet rating. He wouldn't have been interested in sitting back in the passenger cabin with the flight attendant servicing adult beverages and food. Now, he would want to be up there in the cockpit flying. And he'd want to do acrobatics in it, which, of course, you can't do. He'd want to do aerobatics. He'd want to do the stalls. He'd want to try the single-engine procedure. He'd want to be involved in all of this. And it's just, that's one of the major regrets. And that he never even knew. It's not that he was sick and wasn't able to do it. He never even knew that we had acquired an EIB-1. But no, I've had a lifelong fascination. What? No, you can't. No, by regulation, you can't do a barrel roll. No, not a corporate jet. That's not that kind of an airplane. No. I mean, these things, most of them will not even fly upside down. The fuel pumps. Well, that's not true. Safety regulations to that, but they're not designed for it. Those are emergency procedures that work for a while, but they're not designed for that kind of torque and stress that you would put on it.
Dang it. I said I was going to get myself emotional today, but now I'm picturing Rush and his parents, you know, in heaven and his father, Rush H. Limbaugh Jr., saying, but son, the plane, what is EIB-1 like? I guess they know what flying is like now, if you believe in that vision of heaven. There's a lot to get to, including Rush told us about why people like Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, they go to podcasting and another Obama or Biden administration nominee or Surgeon General. He's getting a bunch of money from Netflix after he shut down or was a fan of shutting down movie theaters. We'll continue. It's Todd Herman filling in for our departed friend Rush Limbaugh, the EIB Network. It's Todd Herman in for our departed friend, Rush Limbaugh. I can't get over the image of Rush's father talking to Rush about EIB-1 now that they're together in heaven. It's a beautiful image. Rush talked to us a lot about the Democrat Party and the trick of making it seem like they're for the working people and how that was just illusion. And here we are now a week after we've said goodbye to a friend. And there's this Vivek Murthy. He is one of the Obama darlings and Surgeon General type. But then there's this. He took $400,000 from Carnival Cruise Lines, $400,000 in cash, and another $400,000 from Airbnb. All this is for, quote, consulting. And then $600,000 from Netflix. Now, I wonder, did Netflix benefit from the selective lockdowns of small businesses and small theaters that was cheered on by people like Vivek Murthy, right? Is that not a problem anymore? And Rush has warned us and talked to us about that. Look, they are the them in us versus. So it doesn't surprise me that Obama and his boss, Michelle, being handed all this money from Netflix because they're supposedly filmmakers, they're co-hosting a new podcast. And they're going to go talk about this and that topic, marriage and fatherhood and, of course, race and the state of America. Rush once told us why libs flock to podcasting, and he was, of course, right on the money.
You know what podcasts are, Snerdly? What are podcasts? Now, that's technically what they are. But, I mean, in the real world, what is the purpose of a podcast? The podcast is the liberals failing to do talk radio, so they go to that's what podcasts are. Now, we were first with podcasts. We were first to podcast this program. We were listed when Apple first introduced podcasts to iTunes. We were on the list of the first original offerings. We date back to the beginning of podcasts. But I'm telling you, the left has infiltrated the entire podcast meme because they can't succeed on talk radio. I mean, more power to it. I'm just telling you what it is. There's a lot of conservatives that do podcasts too, but I'm just telling you, for the left, that's an attractive place. And that's why they promote them all over the place.
Yeah. And for every podcast, for every film that's supposedly put about the Obamas, there are starving filmmakers who are good Hollywood leftists. And aren't they asking themselves, wait a minute, these guys, they don't make films. Why are they getting money I should get? Speaking of that, let's talk to Ken in Livonia, Michigan. Ken, you're on the Rush Limbaugh program. Todd Herman sitting in for a departed friend. Welcome, Ken.
Yeah, I just wanted to call and give one of many examples of why I would see Rush Limbaugh as an American patriot. We are now living in a time where all of his enemies want to keep throwing mud at him. But I want to show some light on how he's actually changed my life, and I believe so many others. At the time that I met Rush Limbaugh, which goes back to when he was on television, without a doubt, I was a socialist. Now, some people would say, well, how do you know you were a socialist? Well, I was a 100% strong supporter of the Democrat Party. I had read their platform. I approved of it. I had read the Communist Manifesto written by Karl Marx. I agreed with it. And I said at that time, hey, I'm a socialist, man, just like all the Democrats are today, socialists. Now, because of the education that I got from Rush Limbaugh, education on economics, education in history, and talking about the U.S. Constitution, why it was created, everything I learned from Rush Limbaugh, and then I went out on my own and investigated to make sure what he said was true. Today, where I was an atheist slash socialist, today, because of the influence from Rush Limbaugh, I'm a Christian who is a constitutionalist who believes in the free market system. And here's the difference that I saw thanks to Rush. Any country that follows the belief system, the worldview held by the Democrat Party, and unfortunately now even many of the Republicans have joined in, we end up being the former Soviet Union. We end up today being Venezuela, China, Cuba. Well, I believe in freedom. You know, I want to live in a nation where I'm a citizen under a small government, not a servant, a subject under a big, fat, bloated government like we see here in Michigan, what we see in Washington, D.C., because here's the big thing that I learned, and I'll apply that to today. And there again, I'll attribute this to Rush Limbaugh. God gave me intelligence, and intelligence tells me Dr. Fauci and the CDC, they're not my God, and I'm going to follow my God that has given me intellect. And so since I know that all the research scientists have come out and said that wearing a mask is 100% useless.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay away from wearing a mask because I know that they're no good.
Good. You know what you're doing? And I hate to cut you off because the clock becomes our enemy. What you've said here, first of all, let me say God is great that Rush helped bring you to that. But your recognition, Ken, your recognition that being a big person requires a small government. You said that so well. This is why I describe myself as a small government, big person person. It's why Rush had so often, as you just said so well, talked about the bloat, talked about these people and organizations who feel themselves godlike. And I remember Rush talking about the amount of water Congress would allow in toilets, or the light bulbs that Congress would deem to allow us in our homes. And now we're on the edge of government now deciding what's true, literally having truth czars. They're proposing this. Rush was right on that, and I'm just so pleased to know that he helped turn your life around, and now you're a functioning member of society completely. Thank you so much for the call, Ken. It's Todd Herman on the EIB Network. It is, because it's right back in discussion, the minimum wage, without what you would consider, you know, the equal and opposite insistence upon a minimum effort. Notice that never enters the equilibrium of the discussion. It's been, minimum wage has been discussed forever on Rush's show. And lots of lessons about that. And Rush has said many times that what the Democrats want to do is raise the minimum wage as an assault on small business. They've said as much this week. A Democrat congressman from California said, we don't want small businesses. So he's a Democrat. Yeah, he's let that out of the bag. He's admitted it. So here's an example perfectly laid out. And I see you. Or see, I told you so moment. This is over the weekend on CNN, which used to be a news network, Inside Politics. The host is Abby Phillip, and she's talking to this Democrat, Ro Khanna, Democrat from California. And she says, is now the right time to increase the minimum wage to $15?
Abby, it's absolutely the right time to give working Americans a raise. Let's look at the facts. Amazon raised their wage to $15 nationally, not regionally. They have more jobs today. That didn't hurt job creation or business. Target followed. They also did it nationally. More jobs.
Well, of course, large businesses like Amazon and McDonald's, for example, can and perhaps should pay more. But I'm wondering, what is your plan for smaller businesses? How does this, in your view, affect mom and pop businesses who are just struggling to keep their doors open, keep workers on the payroll right now?
Well, they shouldn't be doing it by paying people low wages. We don't want low wage businesses.
What? Let me translate that. We don't want starter businesses. We don't, you know who gets zero minimum wage? Business owners when they start up. I've done it six times. Not paid myself a dime, one time for a year. Remarkable. So here's Rush. Now, this is less than a month ago, you guys, January 29th. And this is El Rushbo explaining the Democrats' true desire is to attack these small businesses. Like Amazon and Target, they didn't get locked down, right? Rush said that they want to eliminate them because the truth is that the Democrats have become the party of big business.
A question, ladies and gentlemen. How many millions of jobs will be lost if the Democrats raise the national minimum wage to $15 an hour? The national, a federal minimum wage, not state, not neighborhood, not city, not local. Federal minimum wage, because back on Tuesday, the Democrats introduced a bill that would raise the minimum wage nationally to $15 an hour over 5 years. It would more than double the current minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. It's called the Raise the Wage Act. Oh, it's so simple. It would increase pay from $9.50 an hour in 2021, $11 in 2022. 2023, it would rise to $12.50 an hour. It would hit $14 an hour in 2024. It wouldn't be until 2025 that it hits $15 an hour. You know how many jobs would be lost? This is guaranteed to be true, but this is not speculation. It's not conservative theory. We have enough data with the imposition of the minimum wage in various states and cities, various local levels. We know what happens with the implementation of a minimum wage. And the number of jobs that will be lost would be at least 1.3 million, according to the Congressional Budget Office. which means that members of Congress are okay with it. They're going to move ahead with the legislation anyway, even though their own budget office says you're going to cost the country 1.3 million jobs. Truth is, it's going to be higher than that. Most economists who are not socialists think the number will be much higher. Now, I have attempted over the 30 years of this program to explain the minimum wage and why it's a bogus proposition countless times, and I'm going to do it again. I have found over the course of my hosting the program that the minimum wage is something that a lot of people are just sympathetic to, the way it's presented to them. Well, you can't feed a family of four and $15. Well, then why isn't it higher than that? This is the question I always ask. What is the minimum wage? The minimum wage is an arbitrary amount of money that business owners, the majority of whom are small business owners, will be required by federal law that they have to pay, whether the people they hire are worth it or not. The reason the minimum wage costs jobs is because if a business, a small business, currently is paying people entry level at $8 an hour and all of a sudden are told they have to pay them 10, well, they don't have the money laying around in a vault that they're not using. But a lot of people think that if you are a business, that you're a millionaire. If you're a business, you got all kinds of money that you're not spending. You're hoarding it, and you're keeping it for yourself rather than giving it to other people and your employees because you're a cheat, because you're selfish. Such is the damage to the reputation and image of business people that the left has succeeded in creating. So what has to happen in the real world? Business owners have to let employees go. They have to fire them because they don't have an endless pile of money they could be paying people with but aren't. Most small businesses have very small margins. They're not just barely getting by, but it's not, they're not a bunch of hedge funders, let's put it this way. But the real problem is it's an arbitrary number that is mandated on them. It has no relationship to the business that they're in. It has no relationship to their profit and loss. It has no relationship whatsoever to the business they're in and how the cost of doing business are, what the current profit margins are. They just slap on an arbitrary figure. It has nothing to do with market conditions. And the arbitrary figure is one that is created by politicians that they can get behind as compassionate and understanding and they care about people. Well, people end up losing their jobs because of the minimum wage. It's much easier to trim your workforce than it is to go out and somehow make people more productive. And making people more productive is how you end up being able to pay them more. Your business growing. But the arbitrary minimum wage is a direct assault on small business growth, which is the primary bottom line to why it's just a guaranteed failure. It's been tried, it's been proven over and over again. It doesn't matter. This is the Democrats using their power when they have it. And the purpose of this is to create failures in small business, to run them out of business, to make sure that they have all kinds of trouble making their ends meet. You might say, well, why would anybody want to do that? Because it'll turn them into dependents on the government, folks. It always circles back to that. In addition, the nationalization of a $15 an hour minimum wage, which again will not hit until 2025. If $15 an hour is what's needed, why not do it this year? Why have to wait till 2025? And if $15 an hour is good, why not 20? You know, try an experiment with somebody. This always works. Talk to somebody who's in favor of the minimum wage. You won't have any trouble finding people. They've been brainwashed on this for a number of years. And keep asking, okay, well, if $15 an hour is good, why not 20? And they'll agree with you. Oh, yeah, I could go for that. And just keep bumping it up. Okay, you like 20? What about $25 an hour? And they'll agree with you. At some point, when you keep bumping up the number, you'll reach a number where they will say, no, we can't do that. It may be 35 an hour. It may be 25. It may be whatever. But you'll reach a point where the person you're talking to who loves the minimum wage will tell you, no, 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 that's too much. At that point, you pounce. And you say, why? Why is 35 too much when 30 isn't? Why is 35 too much when 25 isn't? And they will not have an answer for you. Some will, actually, and the answer they have will make your point. Well, I mean, that's just too much to mandate that somebody be paid for that before you know whether they're worth it. Aha! Well, why did it take 35 to get you to realize that? Why didn't you realize that at 25? Why didn't you realize that at 15 or 20? The point is, you're not really arguing with them about a specific number. The reason you're doing this exercise is to get them to finally react at whatever number that it's not right to put that kind of a burden on business. At that point, you've won the argument. Here's what else it does, though. It destroys youth and minority employment because the minimum wage is not designed to support a family of four. There is no way. It never has been. It's entry level. It's designed to pay people who don't have any experience doing the job. And what it does, it wipes out entry-level jobs, and that's what people that have never done work before need. They need entry-level jobs to learn how to survive in the work culture. They need to learn how to show up and to show up on time. They need to learn how to follow directions. They need to learn how to engage in productive behavior. They need to learn the satisfaction of doing a job well. That's what the whole point of entry-level work is. Entry-level work is not designed to support a family. You weren't ready to support a family when you were 16 or 17. You left home. You wanted to go get a job that you weren't capable of it. You had to learn the work culture. That's what entry-level work is all about. But, of course, wiping out entry-level positions, destroying minority employment, that's kind of the plan, isn't it? It just forces businesses to move to automation. That's what's going to happen. Businesses eventually say, you know what? I can't deal with this hassle. I can't deal with you people telling me how much I have to pay people when you don't even know what the work is. You don't even understand what I do in my business. And I'm not going to put up with it. I'm going to try to automate as much of this work as I can. Andrew Yang, of all people, has laid this all out. They want to destroy jobs. Why would they want to do that? That's a tough thing to say, right? No, it's not. They want to destroy jobs by replacing as many as they can with automation. Why? Well, that's how Andrew Yang believes that he can get his universal basic income of $1,000 a month passed into law. When people do not have any job, when they don't have work to do, when they don't have a job to go to, they still need money, still need food, still need to pay the bills. Hey, I got an idea. How about a guaranteed universal income? $1,000 a month, universal basic income. Not to mention this will wipe out a lot of restaurants who managed to make it through 2020 still alive. And they're going to raise taxes in the midst of this? They're going to raise taxes while they are raising the minimum wage? I don't know, folks.
That's our friend Rush taking the complex, not just making it understandable, but giving us hints on how we can help our fence-leaning friends understand it. More to follow. It's Todd Herman in on the EIB Network. It's Todd Herman in for Rush Limbaugh. Our friends, departed, God has called back his loan on the talents, as Bo Snerdly so well said. Man, there's a lot. How am I shocked? 30 years of broadcast excellence. I'm not shocked. I'm consuming this differently today, you guys, because I'm a listener. Now I'm sitting in a studio and listening to it in a radio studio as this is why he changed the medium. Because I'm not just listening, I'm analyzing. It's just a remarkable career in life. Let's talk to Sean's in Queens, New York. Sean, you're on the Rush Limbaugh program. It's Todd Herman filling in for our departed friend. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Todd. What's up, man? Thank you for doing what you do.
My pleasure.
I just got to hold it in a little bit.
Yeah.
We knew Rush had you. like he had me. I've been listening since I was 17. My dad put me on the Rush, and 27 years in, you know, I was a student of the EIB. And Rush had you when you knew you implemented his phrases into your daily speech. I would call my friend Skulls Full of Mush. I would talk about the Chinese and say, Chaikong. And they're like, yo, what's a Chaikong? I'm like, oh, listen to Rush Limbaugh. You know, I called my mother a feminazi one day. She's like, what the hell is a feminazi? Sorry, excuse my language. I'm sorry. You know, but you knew Rush, he just had you. You know, like, he was just a part of my life. You know, he was, there's not a day that goes by, man, that I don't shed a tear for this man. And
yeah.
I can only imagine what, you know, Lady Catherine's going through and Snurley and the whole team. And, you know, just, it's rough, dude. It's rough, but, you know, thank God we have, you know, people like you that can fill in and just keep us, you know, linked to him, you know, and it's just, it's rough, brother. It's rough, but I miss him so much. I had the opportunity to finally call in February 18th, 2020. And, you know, Bo Snurley said, you know, get straight to the point. And I, you know, I knew Rush was having a rough day and he was kind of sick. So I got straight to the point and I never got to say to him, longtime listener, first time caller, mega diddles. Yeah. And I'm sick. That I never had that opportunity to say that to him.
Let's do this now, my brother. Let's together say mega prayers, Rush, and we hope you're enjoying heaven.
Mega prayers, Rush, and I hope you're up in heaven smiling down on us. And we miss you, brother. We miss you dearly.
Man. Yeah. And
yeah. I'm just, God.
You did it, man.
Thank you so
Sean,
much.
Brother, you did it. Thank you so much for the phone call and for being a Queensonian on Rush's show. Thank you, Sean. God bless you. Great call. Todd Herman in on the EIB Network. Well, from all across the country, people remembering Al Rush in that way. What a great call from Queens, New York. One of the skills that Rush brought to the table of the many was just what he just did with the minimum wage. They're taking something that can be made complex and breaking it down into understandable chunks. We had a caller who had to drop off, or a drive-by caller, who said, how do you do that? Like, you know, how do you examine an issue and not get drawn into it? I don't know what the Maha's internal monologue process was. I know that he operated by principles, and he talked about these principles and know who the left is and know they must be defeated. They cannot be, you know, reasoned with, leftists. So he had these principles, and principles like if you tax something, you get less of it, right? That you make something more expensive, you get less of it. That's one way to communicate the minimum wage. You make something less affordable, people will purchase less of it. If starter employees, people starting out, are more costly, businesses will hire fewer of them. And you know who's waiting in the wings are the same companies that Democrat governors gave huge bonuses to with their lockdowns. Tech companies pay people to do the math on when do the kiosks come into play. Rush said that as well. Coming up, lessons from Rush on how we can look at this insane, bloated, supposed COVID relief package Joe Biden's dementia is proposing. Todd Herman on the EIB Network. It is always an honor to sit in this seat on the EIB Network, and I give Mark Stein the credit for announcing that he feels, when he fills in for Rush, that he's still filling in for Rush, and so do I. On today, the day that God has made is a gift for us in the time of which he's decided we'll live. This is a weird way to say it. I am having more fun than a guest host dash human should be allowed to have. And it's somewhat bittersweet. It was a week ago when we learned of Rush's passing, and Catherine, his beloved wife, came to these airwaves to announce that. It was then tomorrow will be a week anniversary from when I had the unbelievable honor to bid Rush farewell with all of you. And this team of Rush's, that mutual love is so profound. It is just profound, you guys. And so there is a bittersweetness to this, that it's a week since Rush's passing. I can't tell you how enjoyable this is to take today's news topics, a $1.9 trillion COVID package. Looks like it's going to pass. The Democrats are willing to do a budget reconciliation move, meaning they can pass this with no Republican votes. Basically, they just shove it through. And it includes things like $135 million for the National Endowment for the Arts. And apparently, I guess they're creating lick-on mRNA injections, so you don't have to get stuck. You just lick a National Endowment for the Arts painting. Right? So it is fun also to realize that in the news of the day, we still have Rush Limbaugh. Rush spoke about the fact, you know, that Democrats survive on good intentions. Democrat regimes survive that. Okay, so there's bloat and $10 billion stolen from the COVID relief packages. But come on, they meant well. And Rush spoke about the fact that when it's against Republicans, it's not the evidence that matters. Remember this? It's the what? Seriousness of the charge. We do remember. But for Democrats, all that matters is good intentions. And that is how leftist regimes survive.
All right, let me answer my own question. I'm best at that anyway. Because, A, it's a good question. B, the answer's even better. And C, this is the kind of thing that the network's going to play for their guests to react to on future shows. My question to the good doctor we just had on the phone, if every government agency is over budget, and it is by default, and we're spending $1 trillion a year that we don't have, we're nowhere near balance, so it doesn't matter. Every agency is over budget. So my question to him was, it really doesn't matter, does it, what the budget is? They're going to spend it. So when they spend it, why don't they spend it on staffing the VA with doctors? And if the answer comes back, well, there's a limit, you know, there's a budget, and we can only spend it. No, that doesn't wash, folks. The budget doesn't matter. This government is spending on whatever it wants to spend. Look at Obama's budgets that are submitted every year. I don't care if they're DOA. I don't care if they never get voted on. Look at the desire. There is no spending limit. There is no real limitation on spending. That's why the Tea Party exists. You know it, and I know it. Left to their own devices, these people would spend money without any regard for the consequences in a fiscal sense. So why do they not actually spend it on doctors? And here comes the controversial answer. That's not the purpose of government. The purpose of government from the left standpoint is not results. If it were, LBJ's great society wouldn't be a dismal failure. Remember, we're not supposed to look at the results of liberal programs, are we? There aren't any that are successful. Every social program to come down the pike that the Dems, liberals have authored has busted up minority families, destroyed the border system in this country. I mean, it's a disaster. The social fabric, the cultural rot taking place in this country is again the result of policy put in place by Democrats. But with what? Good intentions. Yes, we are only supposed to judge the good intentions. Social Security, Medicare, war on poverty, you name it, all of them are disasters. And because of that, we're only supposed to look at the intentions. The VA's got a lot of good people in it. But it's always the case, the mindset of the people that run it, when you have a Democrat, like Obama particularly, in office, results are not what matters. It's a real simple question. If you are going to go over budget, if money really doesn't matter, and isn't that, when you get down to it, the thing, the money doesn't matter. They'll always say, well, we've got budget, we can't hire more doctors. Budget limits. But they never use that excuse to say they can't grow the size of the agency. So if you're going to spend money you don't have anyway, why not spend it on getting more brain surgeons, spinal surgeons, if that's what the VA needs, get them in there. Why not get a bigger bang for the buck on actual medical care in the VA? Why not do that? I don't know, but it's a choice. If they're going to spend more money than they have anyway, this is my point. It's like the analogy I could best give you would be the house bank. If members of Congress could go write personal checks for any amount of money, regardless what was in their account, then it really didn't matter what their salaries are. If a member of Congress earns $150,000 and has $5,000 in the bank, but can go write a personal check for cash for $25,000 on credit with the assumption it's going to be paid back, then doesn't really make the, it doesn't need the money to cover the check. Okay, well, same thing with every cabinet-level department. The money doesn't matter. If we're over budget anyway, and if there's no concern for being over budget, and there isn't, when's the last time anybody submitted a budget with less money than the year before? There really isn't any concern about this. Hello, that's why the Tea Party exists. So my only point is, if the money really isn't an obstacle, it's just something you pretend is for the consumption of the public. You have to make the public think you care about the budget. You have to make them think you care about federal spending. But when the rubber meets the road, you don't care. You're spending on whatever. It's not yours, and that's the fun of being in government. Unlimited amounts of money, and just go spend it. But if there is never an effort to balance the budget, then what does it matter if you go over budget by a dollar or $10 trillion? Well, the only limiting factor is what you think you can get away with. And there may be a little bit of conscience, but more likely a political calculation. So if there's no real concern for the budget, if there's no real concern for going over budget, if you're going to spend money that you don't have anyway at the VA, and if you're going to spend that money on something other than doctors and patient care, then what are you doing? Well, you're obviously not concerned with results, medical results. You're doing something else with the money. You're growing the administration. You're providing more jobs for fellow travel liberals, fellow traveling liberals. You're providing more administrative jobs to get more liberals in the bureaucracy, career that are never going to be fired once they're hired. Can't be. These are not political appointee jobs. You're growing it to put more liberals at work that come out of college with this degree or that degree, maybe don't have any degree, just hire them. This is how you grow government. This is how you expand your influence of your department. Same thing with the IRS, whatever agency it is. This is why it matters to me who wins elections. This is why it matters conservatism versus liberalism when it comes to spending and responsible budgeting and so forth. And this is just, we're out of control here. But even with all the money that we're spending, and it's incomprehensible, the amount of money we're spending. It's incomprehensible. Look at the lack of results we're getting for it. For crying out loud, with all the money we're spending on creating jobs, why aren't there any? With all the money we're spending growing the economy, why isn't growing? All the money we're spending on, you name it, why isn't it happening? Well, there are many reasons. A, government can't do all those things. But B, they're not spending the money on those things. They didn't spend it on shovel-ready jobs, rebuilding roads and bridges and the precious schools. Liberals spend the money on growing the actual infrastructure of government. They create new jobs for nameless, faceless, loyal liberal troops to populate the expanding government. True believers, ideologues to the hilt. If they really cared, and they're going to go over budget anyway, why not pay some doctors at the VA?
Just absolutely as if it's today. The Barack Biden regime wants to give $135 million to the National Institute for Arts and call it COVID relief. How to rush do it? Principles. Show me your budget, I'll show you your priorities. Show me your results, I'll show you your budget. Utterly brilliant. It's Todd Herman in on the EIB Network. Todd Herman on the EIB Network, and it's always on the EIB Network. We are always filling in for our friends who departed this temporal plane and entered heaven last week. I just want to invite you to just think about something as we talk about Rush and what he just described and how it matches what the Democrats are still doing. There's why the Democrat Department of Agriculture head in Florida will not put the flags to half-mast in her building, even though Ron DeSantis, who Rush praised as getting near to a graduate degree from the EIB Institute for Advanced Conservative Studies, although there are no graduates, she won't move the flags to half-mast in honor of Rush Limbaugh because she knows the power of Rush Limbaugh. Incidentally, we heard from callers that apparently people are politely calling her and saying, maybe just do what the governor said. Just saying that. I invite you to think about something. I want to take a phone call from a Rush fan, Doug, here in a second. What if Rush had said, I can't, you know, start a national radio show until I have this minimum income, or until I have this minimum number of stations, or this minimum number of advertisers, or until I have, let's say, 500 stations, then I'll start. We wouldn't have EIB. And what if Rush had said, that's, you want me, you know, I've decided I'm going to write a newsletter, but that's a lot of work. I do the show 3 hours a day, but I'm thinking of working more. You listen to the Limbaugh, you know, morning updates, Rush updates in the morning. It's still running my station in Seattle, KTTH. Of course, we run them every morning. Someone invented that, probably Rush. We'll send this out to the stations. That's extra work. So he put in effort and went above, far universes above minimum wage because he was willing to put in the work. Did you ever hear Rush tell anyone else to do things that he himself didn't do? No. No, the budgets, the process. I mean, the biggest radio show in the world, this one, has a staff sized smaller than my friend who does a government radio show in Seattle on public radio. They have a bigger production staff than the biggest radio show in the world and the best people working on it because it's government. No, there's no minimum workload that people need to take. And this is one of the lessons that Rush taught us from the sun is Democrats don't change. They're doing the same thing now with these bloated budgets. Let's talk to Doug in Cleveland, Ohio. Doug, you're on the Rush Limbaugh program. It's Todd Herman on the EIB Network. Hi, Doug.
Hey, Todd. How you doing?
Doing great.
Hey, I wanted to piggyback on Rush's comment about minimum wage. And so now we're going to start paying people that work at Wendy's $15 an hour. I own my own business. I do photography for real estate. Now, what do I have to pay my employee so that they don't go work at McDonald's or, you know, at fast food? Do I have to pay them $25 an hour? Now it drives the price of what I have to pay up. It also drives the price of hamburgers up. And now what happens to me is I can't hire somebody at $25 an hour starting. They might get there. But the point being is now I have to be something above that. So what is it? What do you pay the person that works at the bank that takes care of my money? Do you pay them $22 an hour now? Do you pay the mechanic $35 or $50 an hour? Because everything else has to go up accordingly. Otherwise, I'm going to be I'm not going to use my brain for anything. I'm never going to excel. And I'm going to sit there and I'm going to flip burgers for $15 an hour instead of actually, you know, doing something positive, more positive than working at minimum wage. It just doesn't make any sense because it affects everyone. It affects the bank. It affects the photographer. It affects, you know, people that work for, you know, or, you know, in radio. It affects every person, every business. And business does not take, and if they want to, a 50% margin, they add 50% to that. It doesn't go up just 50 cents. It doesn't go up just a little bit.
Right. What you're saying,
threefold.
No, but Doug, let me expand on what you're saying. I just want to make sure people understand this because there are people who don't work with margins. So they hear margin and they don't understand that that's the part the business owner gets to keep, right? I once had a relative of mine who is a truly brilliant woman. You can't say she's not. She's got you know, a couple of PhDs. She's a joy to talk to and debate with. And she once asked me, why do businesses even need to earn a profit? And I was dumbfounded. I thought, well, that's what the business owner keeps. But then she's saying, but why so much? Well, why would I risk my capital? This is what people who don't start businesses don't understand. We put our capital at risk, our sweat at risk, and we gamble on it. So when we take on an employee, we're gambling on them. And your explanation of how the person cooking hamburgers, by the way, that's an honorable job. Never look past that. Any legal work is honorable work. And please be proud. Please, I beg you to be proud of the paycheck you earn. If you earn it and it's legal, I beg you to be proud of it. And you gave a great explanation, and it's almost, although we don't get to the level of the Maha, it's very Russian. It's just taking this complex thing and saying, we're going to make everybody more expensive, right? I appreciate that phone call, Doug. That's perfect. That's a perfect way to put it. And if more people would think of it this way, as Doug from Cleveland did, he's a photographer. There's people who deliver him perhaps film or cameras. There's people who work on his cameras. Those people who work on cameras or for the top photography gear, they're skilled. But someone below that is inserting screws into the stands for the lighting. And someone below that is assembling the boxes that the stands go in if they're going to be sold, right? They need to be in boxes. And someone is pumping gas into the car. If you're in a forced, in state like Oregon, where you're forced to use full service gas, someone's doing that. At every single level, these costs go up. And to the point that Doug made about, you know, making people too expensive, so he has to pay people more, except for automation. I tell you the truth when I tell you that big tech, who so benefited from the selective, medically useless, deadly, politically motivated lockdowns, they pay people money to create mathematical models on when your job is over and when their software takes over your job. And they have the number nailed, and they know exactly what it's going to be, and it might be a $15 per hour federal minimum wage. It's Todd Herman in for Rush Limbaugh on the EIB Network. There's a bunch of calls missing points about Rush explaining the minimum wage, reminding us that, okay, yes, the person who is doing the hamburgers or, you know, washing cars, that wage goes up. We had Doug say then the wages he has to pay people at his photography studio goes up. And what about people on fixed income? And it goes right back to what Russ said. If your budget priorities are people, then, and you're going to spend money you don't have, why are you doing ancillary things? Right? Why not just hand it out to people? And if you're going to hand it out, why not give everybody $1 million? It's pure logic. And Rush was so good at that logic. And also, he had the ability to affect. Rush Limbaugh had the ability to hire a metaphorical moving van and to take all his worldly possessions and move into the heads of the Mockingbird media. When he decided to occupy their minds, Rush Limbaugh occupied their entire consciences because he knew how to do this. He knew them, as he might say, by like the back of his formerly nicotine-stained hands. He might say that, right? So Rush loved tweaking the media. He loved driving them nuts. And yesterday in the show, Brett played some classic Rush audio from back in the day that demonstrate how he would take serious issues like abortion and just nuke the arguments of the left and do it in a way that was instructive and funny at the same time. He did that this time that he endorsed Bill Clinton as well.
To Montebello, California, Ann, great to have you. Hi.
Thank you. Rush, the reason I was calling, this, in 1992, I got in my car to go to a business meeting, and you were on the radio, and you were talking that you had been listening to candidate Clinton and President Bush, and you had decided that you were going to support Clinton because he made so much more sense. And you went on and on for 40 minutes that I was in the car how you were going to support Clinton. And I was believing you. It was terrible. You were so convincing. So
what reminded you of that?
You know, I've been thinking about it a long time. How can I forget that? It was, I've always thought about that. But when I came out of my business meeting, after about a half an hour away from the radio, you had talked about, you had been just funny.
Well, let me tell you something. I remember it, too. It was one of, there have been a lot of educational, for me, milestones in this program that have taught me about those of you in the audience and how you interact with and hear this program. Now, let me explain this to people who may, what? Mm-hmm. You endorsed Clinton? People that may not have been. At the time, folks, I was frustrated. I can't tell you. Clinton was lying his head off. Worst economy in the last 50 years. And what really bothered me was people were believing this stuff. I remember I had people calling here saying, Russia can't get any worse, meaning the economy. And it had been worse. It was not bad at all. It was all made up that we were in the worst economy in the last 50 years. And it was, the economy at that point was actually rebounding. But it was just, Clinton had been lying about the philandering, had been lying about everything. And I was near my wit's end trying to get people to believe it. At the time, I didn't realize the fatigue there was with George H.W. Bush. It really, that's what I was not calculating. People were ready for a change. Plus, George H.W. Bush had read my lips, no new taxes, and had gone against that, reversed himself. So he was in his own self-made mess of sorts. So I decided to try to persuade people in another way. So that's what you heard. I opened the program with a 20-minute endorsement of Bill Clinton, basically saying that I had taken a lot of time and really gone over things Clinton had been saying and had rethought them and beginning to see the value in Clinton as a candidate, potential president. And I ended up announcing my endorsement for Clinton. I went to a commercial break and came back. And the phones, of course, were burning and smoking. And when I came back, the calls were just outrageous. I had a Rush to Excellence stop scheduled for the upcoming weekend. The guy on the phone said, I'm burning the tickets. I don't even want the money back. I'm burning the tickets. I'm not showing up. I can't believe you'd sell us out this way. I said, what are you talking about? You just endorsed Clinton. I said, I did not. Well, I heard you. No, you did not. I did not endorse. There's no way I would endorse Bill Clinton. And I kept denying it for an hour. Every call. You did. I heard you. No, I didn't. And then after a while, I started using Clinton excuses. I said, well, okay, even if I did endorse him, it's a long time ago. You can't hold me accountable for things I did in my youth. You can't hold me accountable for things I did long ago. I just kept denying it. I was trying to. You did. You said. And I finally said, if you can see that I'm lying to you, why can't you see this about Clinton? And it turned out to be quite effective, although as a radio experiment, it did not have anything to do with Clinton still went on to win the election.
Oh yeah, can I say one more thing?
Sure.
I was in Hawaii at that time. I listened to you from the very first day that you were on there in Hawaii. It didn't take me 6 weeks to get to fall in love with you guys. It took me one day. But I was a new widow. My husband had only been gone a few weeks when you came on, and you gave me something to look forward to every morning. And I'll always be grateful to you for that.
I love that.
Good. Yeah.
Well,
but it was.
Let me ask you this then. When you heard that I had endorsed Clinton, were you thinking, wait a minute, I've been fooled. I've been this guy. Were you getting close to not listening anymore because of that?
Oh, no. I was thinking, no, he's not. He's just, he's not really. No, nope. Well, maybe he is. No.
Yeah, because.
It's just back and forth.
Well, as this thing unfolded, the vast majority of people, I am certain in the audience, got it and understood it. But, and it wouldn't have worked had we not been able to get all these callers who bought it. I mean, you were. Oh, the media? Oh, that the media reported it. They even went and talked to Clinton about it. And the Clinton campaign said, well, we're happy to hear this. Well, I knew we'd get together with them. That's right. I forget. The media reported it. And the Clinton campaign was all excited to hear about it. And then when I explained what the thing really was, everybody dropped it like a hot potato. Media dropped it. It stopped being a story. And I thought, this has to have worked. I mean, I've just not just told people, I've demonstrated how this guy is doing it. But he still went on to win the election, and I don't think any of that mattered. I think people were ready for a change, and it was kind of like a replay on John F. Kennedy in his inaugural address, 1960, talking about the time to pass the torch to a new generation. And that's what the contrast between George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton also represented for a lot of people. And plus, this was also key. Clinton and Hillary had it down pat. He did not come off as anywhere near the left-wing ideologue that he is and was. She did all that. She didn't have to get the votes. He did. So he was able to adopt this position of moderate Democrat, reasonable, even did his sister soldier moment, you know, which ticked off the Reverend Jackson. But Hillary was able to go out and be the radical leftist of the two. And that was great teamwork on their part. And that has never changed. It's always been the way they handled him getting elected. Okay, I appreciate the call, Ann. Thanks much. This is...
Did I say something about having more fun than a guest host should be allowed to have? Even as we mourn our friend 1 week since he passed, I remember that moment. And I remember my friends saying to me, well, your guys endorsed Clinton. What are you going to do? And it was... I was panicked. And then, of course, I tuned in... Okay, that's why we remember the wisdom of a friend and celebrate his life. It's Todd Herman on the EIB Network. It's Todd Herman on the EIB Network. As always, we do think of it as filling in for Rush 1 week since his passing. And I have to tell you, I was trepidatious about today because I didn't want to get super emotional like I did Thursday of last week when we bid Rush farewell and Godspeed to heaven. But it's been just the opposite. It's just been a blast. Just as a radio guy, just to hear what that man was able to do behind a microphone. It is just to hear it in a new way, not just as a listener. It's just remarkable. People who didn't know, they didn't know. They didn't care to know. They didn't care to know how much optimism Rush had. He was the eternal optimist. He is now eternally happy due to the grace of God. But he was the eternal optimist. Rush was the eternal optimist. He is now. God has made him eternally happy. There's a soundbite here I want you to hear. This is Armaha with advice on how we can be happy.
How many times have you heard me say, if you want to really be happy and content, turn off the television. Try it, I've said. Turn it off for a week and see how your life changes. Cutting edge of societal evolution. See, I told you so. A new study suggests one possibility, that people are not happier. Maybe we need to be smarter about how we spend our time, and no, that doesn't mean watching more TV. Feeling unpleasant? You can think of your happiness as having three components. There's your basic disposition, whether you're by nature a happy person or not. Second, there's your life circumstances, your age, health, marital status, income. Third factor, which is how you spend your time, something you have a fair amount of control over, the other things you might not. This is the subject of a major new study by academics Daniel Kahneman and Alan Krueger, David, just a whole bunch of idiots. For the study, the five professors studied some 4,000 Americans, asking what they did the previous day and quizzing them in detail about how randomly, about three randomly selected events in the day. The bottom line is, the less TV people watched, the happier they were. Now, I told you to try this years ago. Here's the bottom line on the professors and their study of happiness, contentment, and so forth. The standout cluster was what the authors label engaging leisure and spiritual activities, things like visiting friends, exercising, going to church, listening to music, fishing, reading a book, sitting in a cafe, going to a party. When we spend time,
on our favorite of these activities, we're typically happy. We're engrossed. We're not especially stressed. Time goes by, we're not bored. We have more leisure time than ever before in our society, and yet we're not doing those things. We're zoning out. We're sitting in front of the television. There's been a significant increase in the hours devoted to what the authors call neutral downtime, mostly watching TV. Women now spend 15% of their waking hours at the television. Men devote 17%. Watching TV may be low stress, moderately enjoyable. People aren't mentally engaged the way they are when they're exercising or socializing with other people. Try it, folks. You really should. Just listen to this program and don't watch any television. Don't, especially news. Don't. Don't, and I will get, and spend the time doing things with your family, your spouse, if you can handle that, going out with friends or what have you, just for a week. Maybe even if you can't do that, try 3 days. TV's addicting to some people. And you just see if you're not better off, if you're not more content, if you're less worried all the time.
Took that advice. Haven't had a TV in 20 years. Let's talk to Dave. Oh, it works, by the way. David in Danville, Virginia. You got about 1 minute, David. Welcome to Rush's show. It's Todd Herman filling in. Go ahead, David, with a minute.
All right. Let me first say just mega dittos. And I was talking about back in the early 90s where some of the restaurants here in our local town had Rush rooms and just how packed yes. they were. You had to send somebody down 20, 30 minutes ahead of time so you could get a table. We started noticing some of the management at the dealership that I worked at were disappearing on Friday for 2.5 hours during lunch, but they're sitting down in one of our local restaurants just, and if you were in the restaurant on the other side of the room, it was like a party going on, just belly laughs and cheers, and it was just a great time.
That's such a delicious memory. I remember there was a Rush room in Seattle, a place called the General's Barbecue. I loved the General so much. Great barbecue. You know what? You just brought this terrific memory. Appreciate that, David. Now I'm getting emotional. You did me. I got through the whole show without shedding a tear, and now there's this. David, appreciate the phone call. It's Todd Herman on the EIB Network. I want to thank Mr. Limbaugh for creating such an incredible catalog of work that today, a week after he passed into heaven, we can refer back to his work even as we are current on the news. I want to thank Craig and Ali and Mojo and Crash and Mike and Bo and the whole team, Greg, etc. It's just always an honor to be here. Rush found early on that he wanted to do radio. And I really do believe with my whole heart that God has given each of us a talent. And Rush found his, and we found it. And thank God for that. And the talent that you have, it may not be talk radio. For most people, it's not. But that talent isn't less important. It's not less important. It's not less potent. And so your talent might be you keep a super tidy mechanics shop and you fix cars, and that's really important because that's how people take their families about. Your talent might be that you're willing to run into buildings that are burning down instead of people running away. Your talent might be that you care for your children with your whole heart and your whole soul. All of us, in one way, have talent that God gave us. And it's okay as we look back with a mix of happiness and sadness at the talent on loan from God that made EIB. Also, maybe just give a moment of gratitude for the talent that God gave all of us. It's Todd Herman. It's been an honor to fill in for our friend Rush on the EIB Network.